If you've listened to the show for any length of time, you know that I'm a big fan of connecting with locals when you're traveling someplace. If you're just going to be inside the tour bus, then you might as well stay home. The best parts of travel for me are when you get out into the marketplace or into the cafe where you meet the locals and have a chance to interact. If you're also looking to experience this, then check out Explore Worldwide, whose local tour leaders will get you off the beaten track and into the heart of the adventure, helping you get past being a tourist, experiencing local culture, and finding places you would not find by yourself. And isn't that what travel is all about? If you're thinking about your next adventure, head to exploreworldwide.com to find out more.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 287. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about backcountry and bears as we go to Alaska. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Before we get into this week's interview, I do have one piece of self-promotion and then three news stories. The self-promotion is that today, the day that this episode came out, July 2nd, is the 6th anniversary of the Amateur Traveler. So for all of you who've been listening for a long time, thanks so much for listening. In the first news story, the TSA is in a bit of trouble because apparently someone was able to get through security using a stolen boarding pass and an ID that was not their own. In fact, the boarding pass didn't even have the right date on it. And then speaking of air travel, one airline is trying to make your air travel experience more quiet and pleasant. If you are in first class, they're going to ban children, or at least screaming babies, and that is Malaysia Airlines. And then finally, a news story from Taiwan that's a little scary if you're a blogger. A blogger was given a suspended sentence for 2 years, a 30 days in detention, and a 200,000 new Taiwan dollar fine, about $7,000, because he wrote a review that said that the noodles in a particular restaurant were too salty. The court said because he'd only been there once, he really didn't know. For links to all of those stories, check out the show notes at amateurtraveler.com. I'd like to welcome the show Joe Bickley, who's coming to us from Fairbanks, Alaska, and coming to talk to us about the 49th state in the Union, Alaska. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
So, Joe, why should someone come to Alaska?
Well, this might be somewhat my own personal opinion, but for me, it's the backcountry wilderness and the wildlife as well. Particularly just the large expanses of wilderness. There's so much of it without roads and even without trails. It's something that you don't get in a lot of other places, few other places that I've been. I have traveled some. And also, you know, as I mentioned, the wildlife, it's pretty amazing populations of large mammals like wolves, grizzly bears, moose, caribou, lynx. And, you know, I could go on. And also in the sea, the whales, the seals, sea lions, sea otters. It's quite spectacular at times.
Now, I think a lot of the tourists who go to Alaska do the Inland Passage, do the cruise up there, maybe they do some of the land journeys from Anchorage, you know, seeing a lot of wonderful things, but they're only getting maybe 10 miles into Alaska at any given point. You're way the heck up into Alaska. I mean, Fairbanks is halfway up the state from Anchorage.
That's right.
If we went to more of the heart of Alaska, what would you recommend that people see?
Well, Fairbanks is on the northern end of the road system, but it is actually, you know, geographically located in the center of the state. But I would say further south, Denali National Park is about 2 hours south of Fairbanks and about 4 hours north of Anchorage. And that is a popular place to visit, and for good reason. I highly recommend it for sure. And, you know, my expertise, really, my personal favorite is the backcountry, is the wilderness, like I said. And so for me, I would mention things such as the Alaska Range, which includes Denali National Park, the Talkeetna Mountains, which sit between the Alaska Range and Anchorage. And also closer to Anchorage, you have the Kenai Peninsula, which is a very popular spot for fishing and also for just getting outside and hiking and going on family trips. And, you know, the real limit in Alaska is the road system. There's very few places accessible by road. And so you could list really on one hand almost the popular spots that are accessible from the roads.
Well, you mentioned that you're in Fairbanks, you're halfway up the state, in the middle of the state, and at the northern end of the road system. So that really does give us at least half the state we're not going to be driving to.
Yeah, that's right.
As we go back to your list there, let's do that a little more slowly. Denali, for instance. What can people see in Denali? How should they approach it? What would you recommend? Are we driving in, flying in, hiking in, some combination? When we're in Denali, we really should do what, see what?
Denali, it's a really wild park. It's a huge park. I don't remember the exact acreage now, but I believe it's between 6 and 10 million acres. And basically, since it came into the park system so late, you know, relative to other national parks, they've really kept it wild. And so the main thing to consider, first of all, visiting Denali is that you cannot drive your car into the park, only about 10 miles into it. And there's a single road going about 100 miles into the park, and that same road is the only way back out. And you basically have to go into the visitor center, and you register to get on a bus, whether you're going backcountry camping or just going for a tour. So that's the number one thing I would say about Denali. But most people who visit Denali fly into Anchorage, and then they either, if they're traveling independently, they rent a car or make their own way to Denali. As I said, it's about 4 hours north of Anchorage. And many other people also fly to Fairbanks and travel south just about 2 hours to Denali. The train is another option that I should mention. It's a very nice train system in Alaska. It is fairly touristy in prices. It's not very cheap, but it takes a very nice route that goes in remote areas in some places with views of Denali, the mountain itself. And so for people who would be interested in that, I would highly recommend riding the train either from Anchorage or Fairbanks.
And just to put it in perspective here, I'm looking up and I'm finding that Denali is 415 square miles. Now, I think that compares to, I'm seeing a little different numbers here, but Rhode Island is roughly 1,000 square miles.
Yeah.
So we're almost half the size of a state.
That's right. It's amazing some of the spaces you get up here. And that's not even the largest. Wrangell-St. Elias National Park, which is located in the southeastern portion of the main body of Alaska. I know that one is over 13 million acres. The largest national forest is also in Alaska, the Tongass National Forest, which is 17 million acres plus. That's in southeast Alaska. It's comprised of lots of islands. And you know, I could go on and on with numbers such as this. It's really amazing some of the large expanses that we have. You know, certain islands are bigger than other states as well. So.
So you mentioned that, and then you mentioned that that was part of a larger range of mountains.
Yes, Denali National Park is part of the Alaska Range. And just to help folks who are particularly interested in the mountains in the backcountry, to give a large general view geographically of Alaska, there's the main body of Alaska, which is essentially a large square. And then southeast Alaska comes off to the southeast, obviously, as a panhandle. It's an archipelago of islands. And then the Aleutian Islands sweep out off the southwestern corner of the main body of Alaska and sweep in an arc in a northwesterly direction about 1,200 miles towards Asia, almost to Siberia and Japan. And so that's the general layout of the state. And the Alaska Range, where Denali National Park is located, sweeps from the southwestern corner of Alaska of the main body in an arc up north, and then back down to the southeast. And Denali National Park is in the northern center part of that arc of the Alaska Range.
So it sounds like basically geographically, Denali is really part of the Aleutians, it sounds like. It's just a little global warming away from being an island.
Well, actually, it's not really, to be honest with you. It's, Denali's right in the center of the state, essentially, and it's very far inland. But the Alaska Range does sweep down almost to the Aleutian Islands. The Alaska Range is the young and still growing of a mountain range of Alaska. You know, it's comparable to the Rocky Mountains or the Himalayas for those who are interested in Asia. But it's a mountain range that is still growing. You know, the mountain Denali itself is growing each year.
We talked about Denali, and of course it has two names we should also mention because some people have heard of it by a different name. But it is the tallest mountain in the U.S.
That's right. It's the tallest mountain in North America.
And also known as?
It's also known as Mount McKinley. And most people use Denali in Alaska because McKinley was a politician, perhaps a senator. He was from Ohio, who never actually even came to Alaska. It's kind of a less than popular name here.
He was a president. He was a president who was killed in office, was assassinated, and Theodore Roosevelt took over for him. So he was president in the 1900s, the turn of the century.
Well, there we go. He deserves his respect as president, but it's he certainly has not been to Alaska.
No, not so far as I know. Okay. And again, when we're tackling, if I'm going up to Alaska and I only have a couple weeks vacation because I'm an American, I can't see all of Alaska. Let's just admit that at this point. So we're picking out some key things. As I'm going up to Denali and I've got a couple days there, two, 3 days there, what one trail, what one drive would you recommend?
Well, most of the park does not have trails, and that's a common thing in Alaska. It's a lot of wild country.
Oh, interesting.
But the benefit is that the tree line in Alaska is at about 3,000 feet. So you get above 3,000 feet, and there are no trees at all. Hmm. And there is a lot of brush there right at that tree line. But once you gain a certain elevation, it's a large, open expanse of tundra, and at times it's like walking on carpet. You know, it's like walking on a golf course almost. And so what you really want to do in Denali or any place in Alaska is either seek the advice of someone who knows, or if you're proficient at reading a topographic map, even better, and look for sites that are well above tree line and with obviously the easiest access to those, and then you can just go wherever you want. And Denali National Park does not have many trails as well. There are a few around the entrance area, but most people, what they do is they go into the visitor center, particularly if you want to go overnight camping. And the rangers there are very good at advising folks on where they can go and some of the more popular spots. One thing I should mention for visitors is that Denali National Park is managed quite well and almost heavily managed by the National Park Service. And even though there are not many trails there, they only allow certain number of campers in each area of the backcountry. They essentially divide the whole park up into a number of park backcountry units. And so basically, anytime you want to go backcountry camping there, overnight camping, you're going to have to go to the visitor center and see what's available and also get recommendations of the best places to go. Since we're not really talking about trails in Denali much, some areas I could recommend right off the bat would be an area near Eielson Visitor Center, which is well a good ways back into the park. And it's all open tundra there, well above tree line. And the Thoroughfare River is a very nice river to hike up. The McKinley Bar leading to the Muldrow Glacier is very nice. And there are many, many others that the rangers could tell folks about.
Thinking of your personal experiences in Denali, what's the best moment you've had in the park?
Well, I've had quite a few. You know, I would say my first summer in Alaska, when I was 19 years old, and I'm 38 now, it's quite a while ago, I went hiking in Denali for a week with my brother. And at that time, I'd learned to read topographic maps pretty well and was pretty confident in this route that I had picked out for us. But I was kind of advised that no one had done that before and that might not be quite possible. But that feeling of just picking your own route and going out and choosing it, and it did work out quite well. And just that sense of self-reliance and the sense of adventure and exploration, it's something that you get in a few other places and you would never get just following a trail. So, you know, I think that experience for me is one that really stands out in my mind, one of the things that really convince me that I love Alaska and I wanted to live here.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned the Kenai Peninsula.
Yes, the Kenai Peninsula is a very popular spot to visit in Alaska. It's probably the most crowded place in Alaska, but before people are immediately turned off by that, I mean, that's relative to other areas in Alaska, and it's very unpopulated.
I was going to say, can you define what a crowd is in Alaska?
Yeah, it's hard to say. There's only a little over 600,000 people total in Alaska, including children, and it's a tremendous-sized state. And so you really, I should also mention that half of the population of Alaska lives in Anchorage, or close to half. And so once you get outside of certain urban centers, such as Anchorage or Fairbanks, the second largest city in Alaska, it's extremely remote. And the Kenai Peninsula, due both to its proximity to Anchorage, but also its popularity with summertime visitors, it sees a lot more traffic. You know, you can see it just in the infrastructure. The roads themselves are better paved. They're better maintained. There's more four-lane highways there, which is kind of a rare thing in Alaska. And there are actually lots of trails on the Kenai Peninsula. Denali National Park and most other areas in Alaska don't have trails, but the Kenai Peninsula has quite a few that the Forest Service, the Park Service, and other federal land management units actually provide and maintain. So for people who are looking to go out on a lot of day hikes and not to go camping much, and who perhaps are not at all turned off by seeing a lot more people on trails and camping in campgrounds with lots of other people, it's a great place to visit. The Kenai Peninsula is very popular for fishing, for those who might be interested in catching salmon or trout or any other type of fishing, even on the coast for halibut. It's really the best place to go. And once again, it will be crowded with fishermen relative to other parts of Alaska, but there's a reason for it. It's a beautiful area. It's a very mountainous peninsula with beautiful rivers that are ice blue and aqua blue in places, and just a tremendous amount of fish.
And I was going to say, the two things I know about the Kenai Peninsula are the fishing, as you mentioned, and then I think most of the pictures I've seen from there are wildlife pictures.
All the communities on the Kenai Peninsula are very fishing-oriented. Many of them are not necessarily the most aesthetically pleasing towns, but some are. For instance, on the farthest south portion of the Kenai Peninsula, there's Homer, which is a very nice town. I think just about anyone who would visit it would like it a whole lot. It's a beautiful setting on a bay surrounded by mountains, and when the weather clears for you, it's really beautiful views with glaciers across the bay from the town. And it's just has an artist culture there and good food, a few good restaurants, and nice cabins to rent outside of town. So I would highly recommend folks who do take the time to drive down to Homer, I would highly recommend staying there several days.
Now, you mentioned the first summer you were in Alaska. Obviously, you get more tourists in summer than you do in other months. Would you care to make a case for why we should see Alaska in other months, or is summer really the time to go?
Well, summer is the time to go, I think. I would say, really, to be honest with you, my favorite time of the year, though, is what we call fall, which would really be a late summer, early fall. Both the spring and the fall seasons in Alaska are very abbreviated, and you could almost make spring part of winter, especially compared to other people's spring. You know, spring in Alaska is March and April, and March is really still winter, but from March 21st and afterwards, there's just as much light in Alaska as anywhere further south. There's more, in fact. You know, with each day, we gain more and more. And so March, even though it snows a lot and it can be very cold, it is a very sunny month. And many people in Alaska say that is their favorite month, particularly for getting outside, for skiing, for mountain climbing, mountaineering, and snow machining, and that sort of thing. I would highly recommend September, particularly the first 2 weeks of September. This is what Alaskans would call fall, and it is fall. There are fall colors, and the berries are out in abundance, particularly in late August and early September. And there are still fish to catch. The silver salmon run in September. But it's just a beautiful time of year. There are very few tourists here in all of September. And so you can really get more of a feel for the local feel and the culture of Alaska without being as many tourists. And yet, it lasts 2 weeks of August. It's still summer, but it's starting to be fall in most places. And the first 2 weeks of September, it's not so cold at all that it should scare anyone or that it should make anyone hesitate to come at that time.
Are there any particular special days that you would recommend people be in Alaska? If you're in that area at all, be sure to be in this town on this day.
I really can't recommend. I could mention a couple. July 4th in Seward, they have a marathon where people run up the mountain and back down, and the town gets, it's a small fishing town on the coast. It's actually on the Kenai Peninsula, but it can be a fun time. The summer solstice, which would be June 21st or 22nd, you know, we just had it. It's really a spectacular time to be here. You never know what the weather is going to be like on that particular day, of course, but any time within a couple of weeks of the solstice or even a month on either side, it's essentially going to be light all the time. And when you get nice weather and you're the type of person who may want to stay up late at night, either hiking or in town, it's really a lot of fun. You get so much energy from being up in the light in the middle of the night, and it can be a great experience for people who haven't seen that before.
Seward, I assume we're talking about the same fellow that was Secretary of State who bought Alaska, Seward's Folly?
Yeah, I believe it must be. His name is on a few things of interest here in Alaska. But yeah, that would be him.
What's going to surprise me when I get to Alaska? I've watched Northern Exposure, so I must know a lot about Alaska.
That's funny. Yeah, I think a cousin of mine who came here and worked for a month, he mentioned to me once, he lives in Los Angeles, and he's traveled a good bit and lived in some third world countries. But what he said to me really made sense was, once you leave Anchorage, once you get outside of Anchorage, you really are in a third world country. And that's, you know, obviously not the case in any city like Fairbanks or Anchorage, because you're in America then. You see all the fast food, all the hotel chains you're used to seeing. And so it's really nothing particularly special. But once you get outside of those city centers, just immediately you're in wilderness. You know, you can immediately see grizzly bears and lynx and other mammals and other animals that you would really never see in other parts of the United States unless you were deep in the wilderness or perhaps in a certain national park such as Yellowstone. But in Alaska, once you get outside the cities, it's extremely wild, and you can feel like you're in deep wilderness even just riding on some of the major highways. And the culture as well, once you get outside of the major cities, there's really like zero social pressure, and it really shows with the way people dress, the type of cars they drive, their homes. You know, many people in Alaska, including myself, build their own homes. And so it's a real refreshing step away from some of the heavily zoned and gated communities, which are in themselves also nice, but for people like myself, it's quite a refreshing change to see a different part of America.
Well, you were talking about how spread out the population, or at least how few people are for the size. I think I was looking it up and saw that the persons per square mile, if everybody spread out evenly, is 1.2 people per square mile. So basically, if all the Alaskans didn't move out of Anchorage and spread out, you'd have one person per mile.
That's right. And it's really amazing. You get in some places and as you could imagine, you feel like you have the whole place to yourself. Even people who own just a few acres and live in a cabin there, they're generally surrounded by hundreds or thousands or even tens of thousands of acres, which is public land, and there's no development in the foreseeable future. And so you can really feel like you own a forest yourself, even if you don't.
And we haven't mentioned it yet, but you have a website, Alaska Backcountry Consulting, that helps people get out into the backcountry. If you have the time, what's your favorite spot to get out in the backcountry?
Well, I have a few favorite spots, but the first one that comes to mind, a place I revisit many times, and in fact, I was just there the past 4 days hiking, is the Denali Highway. And the Denali Highway is a gravel road which runs roughly between Denali National Park on its western end, and it goes about 130 miles east to the Richardson Highway, which is a paved highway. And really anywhere along that highway, it's a really wild and spectacular area. You have these Talkeetna Mountains on the south side of the Denali Highway and the Alaska Range just on the north side. And so you have a choice of mountain ranges between the heavily glaciated and high peaks of the Alaska Range to the north, and then the more mellow, rolling tundra mountains of the Talkeetnas to the south. And it's a place, the Denali Highway is a place where you can just, you would need your own car here, but if you could rent a car, you can just explore all you want. You can camp wherever you want, and it's just spectacular hiking to be had. Particularly, I would highly recommend on the eastern side of the Denali Highway near Paxson. There are a number of large lakes in that area, the Tangle Lakes Recreation Area, Glacier Lake, 7 Mile Lake, the McLaren River. They all are located close to one another and have just spectacular views of the high mountain ranges and glaciers when the weather agrees.
And I think a lot of people these days, as they're seeing Alaska on TV, they're saying most dangerous catch or something like that. And so they know about salmon and they know about king crabs. Is there anything else we should taste when we're up in Alaska? You mentioned the berry season.
Yeah, if you're a hiker or a person who even just goes out for the day, the berries, and starting in late July, you start seeing blueberries. And throughout the month of August, it's an amazing abundance of blueberries, raspberries, cranberries, a berry called a salmon berry, which is basically like a large purple blackberry, grows down the coast. But those are amazing. You know, of course, catching halibut and salmon are very popular, and rightly so. One of the best things you can do, if you happen to know someone in Alaska or meet someone and get in a conversation about hunting or eating wild game, most Alaskans, including myself, have a large chest freezer that is full of game meat, you know, whether it be fish, seafood, or moose is a very popular meat here to eat. Caribou, somewhat a lesser extent, but it also is popular. But that's a real fun experience, I think. I mean, I love to invite people to try out new foods here that only Alaskans can get, but other people, some of them, can pay lots of money to come up and hunt as a non-resident. But for those who aren't into spending their time or money that way, it's a fun thing to have a cookout with an Alaskan.
Now, I've had elk, but the only moose I have had, I think, is chocolate moose. So is moose a similar sort of meat to elk meat or venison?
Yeah, it is. I would say the caribou meat is closer to elk.
Okay.
It is beef-like, but it's a very, very red and very lean meat, caribou. Mm-hmm. Moose is a lot like beef. You, of course, can get very thick steaks with it, but I would say moose has more of a beef texture, and caribou has more of a venison elk texture.
Okay. What's one warning you would give before somebody comes up to Alaska, or maybe before they step out into the backcountry?
You know, a lot of people, they think of bears and grizzly bears as something that can just come out and get them at any time. And even though that's a bit exaggerated, of course, it is important to have the right knowledge, particularly if you're going to go overnight camping. You really need to know how to handle your food and yourself where you're sleeping with regard to bears. But even more importantly, I would say, or perhaps more commonly, if not more importantly, moose can be very dangerous, particularly moose cows with their calves. The cows are extremely protected of their calves. And if you happen to come in between them or just too close to the calf, the moose cow will charge. And it's essentially like being charged by a horse trying to kill you. As you can imagine, particularly if you're above a tree line or in a tight area where you can't move much and wearing a big heavy pack, it's a real concern. And so it's easy to prevent the situation, but you just really need to be mindful of if you don't approach moose very closely, particularly cows with calves. One other danger I would mention is hypothermia. It's basically your body temperature getting too low. And most people think of that like in a winter time or up high on the mountains when it's super cold and snowy. But it's very common for people to get hypothermia in just a cool, wet, rainy day, like 50-something degrees and raining. And so I would just say one thing people should really keep in mind is having a good rain jacket and just taking care of themselves to keep warm when they're in the backcountry.
Now, I know the old story goes that to ward off grizzly bears, you should have little bells on your clothes so they can hear you coming, and then you should also carry pepper spray in case they attack. And the story goes that if you're trying to tell the difference between a black bear and a grizzly bear from the scat, from the droppings, you can tell because a black bear, the scat contains different berries and leaves, and a grizzly bear contains small bells and smells of pepper.
Yeah, that's funny. Not many people wear bear bells in Alaska. It's usually a good sign that it's someone, their first trip there. Many people here call them dinner bells. I'm not sure if there's really anything to that. You know, I think it would be okay to wear bells if it makes you feel better. But the main thing you can do for bears, particularly in areas where there's a lot of brush and low visibility, is make a lot of noise with your voice. You know, even just talking with a loud conversation, or if you're by yourself, or at times when you're not having a conversation, you can just yell out and just, you know, a lot of people say, "Hey, bear," and repeat that, you know, throughout their hike. And the more and more you hike in Alaska, the more comfortable you get with the terrain and with the animals, and you won't be saying it quite as much. But if particularly in areas where you cannot see what's in front of you, or where the wind is really blowing in your face, it's highly recommended and really essential to make noise, because most of the grizzly bears in Alaska have either never seen a human or they never want to if they have. And so if a grizzly bear or black bear smells you, particularly if the wind is blowing from behind you, it'll be carrying your scent in front of you. And you really probably will not see a bear, because they will smell you from far away and clear out. And likewise, if you're talking and making noise, they're going to hear that voice, and it's something they're not used to hearing, just like the smell of a human. They're not used to smelling the backcountry, and it scares them, and they run. And it's amazing to see this, because there are many times, in fact, I've seen a lot of grizzly bears over the years, and without a doubt, more than half, or the great majority of the bears I see, the first time I see them is when they are running way up a mountain to either side of me, like they had smelled me or heard me coming and started running. And they will oftentimes literally run up and over a huge mountain, you know, thousands of feet above me, and they'll keep looking back over their shoulder, and it'll take them 15 minutes to keep going and keep going. But they are really, really wary of humans in most situations, and there are a few exceptions to that. I won't go into all, but one thing I will mention is that a bear is really protective of a kill of a carcass. You know, if it happens to be eating some sort of meat, which is kind of rare. Bears, including grizzly bears, eat mostly vegetation, unless they are focused on salmon in certain streams. But if a bear happens to be eating a carcass, or even if you just smell something dead in an area, you really want to get out of there. That's a dangerous situation.
Excellent. So it sounds like the best way to protect ourselves is to do all those things that make us stand out when we're in the city, which is talk to ourselves and shout kind of at random.
That's right. Yeah. Talking to yourself loudly is not frowned upon at all here in the backcountry. It's something okay. We all have to do, unfortunately.
As we go to wrap this up, you didn't grow up in Alaska, so you went there, we said, when you were 19. So one thing that you still see and you laugh and you say to yourself only in Alaska.
Well, a lot of the houses and homes you see here are truly quite unique and at times unbelievable. You know, people, and I do some of this myself, but people will build a small one bedroom and live in it as a cabin, and then build another attachment and another. And there's really zero social pressure here at all. And so at times you will see certain homes that look almost like a ship of some sort that has just been added onto slowly but surely. And so if you see certain things like that, they're really funny. But that really stands out in my mind the most.
Okay. Before we get to the last two questions, any other tips that people should know before they go visit Alaska?
Yeah, there's a few things I would say is, first of all, if you're going to be staying in hotels or with a roof over your head every night, or really any night which you're going to be spending the night with a roof over your head, I would highly recommend people seeking out cabins to rent instead of staying in hotels. Hotels in Alaska are like anywhere else, but they are extremely overpriced, particularly in the summer season. And you can get a really nice cabin, you know, the different types, but at not only in a much more reasonable rate, but just in a much better setting very oftentimes. And I know of certain places in different areas where I've stayed myself, where you just get you know, not only are you spending less money, but it's just so much more of a welcoming and Alaskan experience. Likewise, the other thing I would also suggest, this is expensive, but if people can't afford to rent their own car, particularly a 4x4, that's really the way to get out and explore Alaska, particularly a lot of the different gravel roads the tour buses don't go down, like the Denali Highway, the Dalton Highway, which runs north of Fairbanks all the way to Dead Horse and Prudhoe Bay. And there are a few others, but that's really essential. It's tough getting public transportation in Alaska, and it really limits you to where you can go.
Excellent. So last two questions. You know these are coming. Finish this sentence for me. You really know you're in Alaska when what?
You really know you're in Alaska when you've been out in the backcountry long enough to where you've forgotten what day it is. It's quite a feeling, and you have not seen a person throughout that time. But once you really know you're in Alaska when you've been out for long enough to forget what day it is and to really feel a certain sense of ownership of where you are, like you really belong there.
Excellent. And if you had to summarize Alaska in three words, what three words would you use?
Well, I would say vast comes to mind first. It is an immensely huge state, particularly the roadless areas. Unspoiled, I would say also. It's quite a wild place where the animals, the plants, and the ecology still rules. And I would say free also. And that really refers to the people more than anything. But you see a lot of culture and a lot of things here that you don't see anywhere else in the United States or in a lot of other developed countries. It's really free.
And I have to ask, is it true you can see Russia from your house?
Well, you would have to live on the far western coast on the Bering Sea up near Diomed Island, which sits between Alaska and Russia and Siberia. And to the best of my knowledge, that's the only place you can see part of Russia from Alaska.
Okay. And if we wanted to know more about going into the backcountry wilderness of Alaska, where can we find your website?
You can find it at backcountryconsulting.com.
Excellent. Joe, thanks so much for coming on the show and telling us more about your home state.
Sure, it's my pleasure, Chris. I enjoyed it.
I had an interesting letter this week, which I've posted up on the website, under an article called "Where is the Darker Side of Travel?" The letter went like this. I have listened to the Amateur Traveler podcast for several years. After replaying another 40 or so episodes this week, which is pretty amazing, actually, something had caught my attention. You don't ever have people on that are unhappy or critical over their trip. At most, you sneak a quick question about what was so bad, and as usual, the guest takes the hint to downplay any real unhappiness they encountered. I began thinking about how much this resembles a cult, how people are coerced into putting up the facade of utter bliss while traveling. It never occurred to me how censored your show is, and why would it be, considering you are the one who edits, picks the questions, and the guests? Was all of this not to offend the sponsors and limit income, I wonder? None of your show is real, Chris. It makes believe with politically correct dictating every word and downplaying every problem. This is not travel. This is some state-sponsored, spoon-fed re-education camp for what you apparently think are feeble minds. I challenge you to bring attention to the darker side of travel. Have some real guests who actually disagree with you, guests who won't regurgitate the notion of every moment being little magical sunshine bursts, how they can't wait to scurry back into the arms of another country or destination. This is, in short, just plain nonsense. I challenge you to some truth in advertising, perhaps stamping "your results may vary" on every show and every web page should suffice. Most people save several years' worth of money to experience travel to another country, even awaiting a lifetime in most cases. How can you lead these unknowing people and their hard-earned money into the cult of utopia is just wrong. Very, very wrong. Try adding some balance. Dramatic for effect, amateur traveler enthusiast, and still a fan. I'd have to say I was a little surprised with the amateur traveler being called a cult. The point about the amateur traveler being mostly positive stories is true. I think that that really is a fair balance. But to be fair, amateur, the reason I chose the name for the show is amateur means to do something for the love of it. And most of the time, the header of the page, of every page, says travel for the love of it. And really, that is my personality. I am an optimist, and I do love travel, and I don't believe that travel is perfect, which is one of the reasons I always ask, is there one warning you would give? And one of the reasons also that we don't tend to have destination PR people on, because I find that they can't tell me negative news. They can't tell me some of the things that are most controversial that we've had on the show, things like being told not to see the penguins or go up in the arch or go to Disneyland, and things that I get a lot of hate mail for. I'm looking for people who do bring some balance, but we have only done one show that was really about a negative experience because, frankly, I'm not interested. So the show is not going to change because you are right. I do edit the show. We don't actually edit content out of the show, though. And actually, I disagree with almost every guest we have to some small degree, some more than others, obviously, because every guest is bringing their own opinion and mine is different. But with 6 years of The Amateur Traveler under my belt and more than that years of my personality, I'm afraid that this is probably the way the show is going to continue. Some of you wrote in defense. I didn't really feel that it needed to be defended. I thought it was an interesting perspective from somebody who says they love the show, and that's great. Again, I don't have to agree with you either. But as we look back on 6 years of content, I'm hoping those of you who've listened for a while have found something of value, even if we don't go for balance. And frankly, I'm not looking for that kind of balance. I'm looking for someone who honestly and truthfully is in love with a particular destination, and I want to see if they can make you in love with that destination by giving an honest appraisal of it from their point of view. But I did want to bring that up. I thought it was an interesting point and one worth discussing. And with that, we're going to bring this episode of The Amateur Traveler to a close. If you have insults you'd like to share about the show, feel free to do that at amateurtraveler.com. Or you can insult me in person at host@amateurtraveler.com. You can also insult me on Twitter at Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening.